this is a bonus episode in which I am talking to one of my very best friends about her life with dogs and some other things too. This is a conversation with Daisy Carrington. We've been friends since we were kids. We both grew up to be journalists and are now both working in other areas. I hope you enjoy our lively conversation. I miss you.
I miss you too, my love. We won't be gone for too long. I mean, I know it's a couple months, but it will fly by.
So I feel like since I'm going to record this, I feel like I need to explain to anyone listening why I wanted to talk to you, as you are not someone who has a dog or works with dogs. Or I don't think you have even very strong feelings about the things that I do as a dog trainer. But as you know, you are one of my oldest and best friends, and I will take any excuse to chat with you. But a few months ago, back when people went out and did things, you told me that you went and did a story at The Moth.
Yes.
And I was sad that I didn't get to go see it, and also sad that you didn't win, that you came in second, because are such a great and hilarious storyteller that I'm sure you should have won. So I thought, well, what'd you say?
I did feel robbed.
I'm sure you were robbed, and and we just like haven't had a moment where I could be like, sit down and perform it for me. So I thought, all right, well, if I can like have you on the podcast, then it'll be more of like an occasion, and you will be forced to tell me your story, which I guess I've heard, because I've known you for so long, but I haven't heard like the perfect telling of it. So I don't, if you're up for it, but in order to warm up and to justify having you here, I thought we should talk a little bit about dogs first.
Sure.
Why don't you tell me about Zeb?
Zeb. Well, Zeb was.
I think you probably have to talk about your dad in order to talk about Zeb and about your.
That.
You know, you and I both like. I think one reason why we became friends quickly when we met, just to back up, we met when we were seven and took like a acting class together outside of school. And I thought you were, I mean, you know this, but like, yeah. I thought you were just like, I couldn't get my mind around you. You were just such an enigma. You looked like a little like cherub, and you wore like puffy sleeves and called your mom mummy, and you were just like this like hilarious kind of weird cartoon character to me. And I used to see you like in the neighborhood with your mom, and we went to different schools, and so like, but I remember saying to my mom like, that's that girl. And and then first day of ninth grade, you ended up at the school I was at, and I accosted you, and we've been friends ever since.
That was very exciting, you know, like going to a new school and you walk in and someone just comes up to you and goes, I know you.
I know you. But I didn't really know you. I just knew, the person I thought you were, but I didn't really know you. But I think we both had like unusual New York City childhoods growing up with eccentric divorced parents. But you tell us about your eccentric dad and Zeb.
Yeah, my father was a screenwriter, which actually enters into the Moth story somewhat. But, you know, he was definitely a larger than life character, and he loved a good story. But that's all beside the point as far as Zeb is concerned. So Zeb was his dog. And I mean, he had a lot of incredible stories about Zeb. But, you know, I always found Zeb to be like just a very special dog, like. It's hard to explain, like almost kind of supernaturally special. You know, he was just
he was a pit bull, right?
No, he was an American Staffordshire Terrier, which, you know,
okay. Similar.
I think is the same difference, but there's definitely a different physical characteristics.
And did he get Zeb before you were born or after you were born?
After I was born.
Okay. So yeah. He and your mom, Daisy's dad, your dad, he looked like Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. He was like a Hollywood writer and had this Staffordshire Terrier. And yeah, I can't picture like him and your mom who I would characterize as like
Auntie Mame is a good kind of, you know, she was
Auntie Mame common. Or like Ab Fab. Yeah. Absolutely fabulous.
I over the years I've kind of come across letters between the two of them, and like I can see it more in their youth. I can kind of place them together, and you know, apparently they were crazy for each other, but it wasn't really.
No, I can't picture them with the dog together. I could picture them together.
Oh, okay. Yes. apparently they did have a dog together, not Zeb. I know my dad got my mom a dog once named Sasha. I think it was Sasha. And my dad's telling of the experience is that, you know, she really wanted a dog, and he found this dog he absolutely loved, and he kind of wanted it for himself. I guess they weren't living together yet. And he dropped off the dog, and he said it was the strangest thing that ever happened. They both looked at each other, and they just simultaneously took a step backwards and just had no chemistry. And so he was ecstatic because he really loved this dog. And this is one, in addition to Zeb, Sasha was one of his great loves. And I think that he, you know, his dogs really were loves, you know. I mean, I think when he sort of would always tell me the stories of his dogs, I mean, it was like listening to someone talk about an ex-wife, you know. It was... yeah, so it was very intense, and so I mean
an ex-wife like that they actually like,
yeah, maybe like a widow, you know, it's like a widower talking about like you know, their spouse that passed away and they never really recovered
because of Jason. We're talking about his ex-wife as if she was like a long lost dog love. I would
right, that might be, you might be like, I don't know,
upset.
Yeah, like, you know, alarm. But no, it was very much like a widower, you know, and you sort of, you know, to a certain extent, because obviously all the dogs were eventually died. I mean, I think he had them from, you know, the entirety of their lives. I mean, he was a long-term serial dog owner. I remember, and my mom would say that Sasha was never very warm towards her unless I think when she was pregnant, she said that Sasha was bizarrely very warm towards her. I mean, I kind of almost imagine it like a housekeeper.
What kind of dog was Sasha?
I don't know. I'm imagining a golden retriever, but I don't think it was. But it was a light golden dog, but I'm not sure it was a retriever. But Zeb, back to Zeb. Zeb was an American Staffordshire Terrier, and just a very special dog to me. You know, I remember many kind of cuddles with Zeb. You know, in the house, and he did just seem very, very exceptionally bright. And I know my dad, you know, when he got Zeb, he wanted an American Staffordshire Terrier, and he went to go look at some puppies, and he saw Zeb nearby the puppies, and sort of said, you know, thought the puppies were okay, but he was like, they couldn't be, you know, that magnificent dog over there can't be the father of these puppies. And I guess whoever was selling the puppies were like, well, that's actually our neighbor's dog, and she treats him horribly. And if you want to go take him, we'd absolutely welcome you to do it, because, you know, she beats him basically, and she's not very good to him. So, from what I understood, I mean, it's a weird story, and it's kind of a typical story of my dad. I mean, I don't really, you know, he just took the dog who belonged to someone else. And I think eventually the woman, you know, I think it was, a youngish kind of, I mean, from the story I was told, kind of drugged out woman and living in Topanga, California, you know, in Malibu and Topanga ranches, who basically said, you know, I hear you're running around with my dog, calling him yours. And he sort of said, well, I hear that you're a horrible dog owner, and I don't think that you should have this dog. And I guess basically she just, you know, didn't fight it. I don't know. So it's a weird story, but, you know, among the
things.
That's
crazy.
It is really, it is pretty nuts. But, you know, I mean, there was a lot of love between the two of them. I mean, he used to share ice cream cones with Zeb, and that was a bit rough for anyone who happened to witness that. You're like, oh God, you know, I just, you know, he'd get a lick, Zeb would get a lick. You're just like, ooh. You know, I mean, it was, and I did sort of always find, you know, he had the gentlest bite, you know, you could feed him. He was never, there's never anything aggressive about him. He just seemed like, I guess he seemed like a kindred spirit to me, you know, like I think I've always been a bit more mild-mannered, you know, which is sort of in contrast to my dad had a bit of a temper and my mom could be a bit, you know, hot-blooded from time to time. So I think in kind of comparison to that, you know, having this sort of mild-mannered kind of grounded, you know, kind of a very, very spiritual seeming dog, you know, in my midst, it was very comforting. So yeah, there was always something very spiritual seeming about Zeb. And Zeb had a love. Zeb had a one great love named Leona, I believe. It was another dog. And he would go meet her and pick her up from, I think she was at the motel that was that used to exist near my dad's house in Malibu. And, you know, and would beat up other dogs, I guess, who would, you know, try and court her. I mean, all very typical stories of my dad. And, you know, one time when they were, Zeb and her were sort of on their various adventures, she got hit by a car, and apparently Zeb just put his head down on her and stayed with her until I guess they were found, you know, but she died that way. So,
that's a very sad story.
And my dad told me that he was once telling a story about her, and at the very mention of her name, Zeb started to shake, started to convulse, and basically just slunk down real low and kind of crawled into another room and couldn't even sort of handle hearing her name because he was so heartbroken. So, yeah. So those are just a couple of our Zeb stories. But he was around for a long time. He was around until he was, until he was very, very old. You know, so it was a good long life. With lots of, you know, being outdoors and swimming and climbing mountains. I mean, Malibu was brilliant, and then eventually came over to the East Coast. But yeah, he had a good long country rural life.
Do you think your dad ever thought about like dog behavior and dog training?
Yeah, my dad was definitely he was a pretty dedicated dog trainer. I mean, I'm sure his methods would seem pretty old school compared to, you know, how dogs are trained today. You know, it's just like with parenting. You know, I think a lot of parenting techniques are very old school. You know, when you think about what your grandparents,
there's a lot of old school dog training that's still happening as yeah. if it's current.
You know, I mean, so no, he was, I mean, Zeb was incredibly well-trained, incredibly obedient, really good with tricks. Like my dad was very good at teaching dogs tricks. And he just sort of had a natural rapport with both dogs and kids. But, you know, I mean, there was obviously still some sort of techniques, you know, like, I mean, I think every time he had a new dog, he told me that he'd like put it on their back and stare into their eyes and basically just try to establish himself as the alpha, like things like that, you know, that are probably not necessary, but, you know, but yeah, he, you know, I mean, Zeb was definitely very.
I think I did something like that to Amos when I first got him too.
Yeah, right. You know, so it's. I mean, I don't know whether or not that's something that
clearly it works because he's a great dog.
Yeah.
And then you had an iguana in high school.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Was it an iguana or a bearded dragon?
No, it was an iguana. Basically, when I was in nursery, I really wanted a snake. And so my mom was like, you know how you really wanted a snake when you were like a kid? And at this point, I'm like 15. I'm like, what, when I was like in nursery? She's like, yeah, I got you an iguana. And I'm like, okay, so 15 years later, you got me the wrong pet. So I was like, I had no real, I didn't really have any affinity towards the iguana. It was a little bit of a nuisance. I didn't really like buying bugs to feed it, but it was sort of, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, you don't want to be like ungrateful, even if it's a gift, a pet gift that you really have zero interest in. But I think eventually the iguana was given to someone who, you know, outside of the city, who had some space for it, who genuinely, you know, who had other iguanas and who liked iguanas. And I think that was probably a good decision in the end, because it was absolutely
wild. You went to a farm.
Yes, sorry, you went to a farm upstate.
Here's a question about me.
Yeah.
What do you remember about like me and dogs? I mean, because I'm sure like it was, I always seemed like obsessed with dogs compared to you at least.
Not obsessed with dogs. I mean, you had Zeke when we were kids. And I know that you were very close to Zeke.
Wheaten Terrier. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I remember, I mean, I think Zeke had that similar sort of comfort for you that Zeb provided for me. Because I remember there being a time when you had gotten in a fight with your mom and you came to our house, my mom and my house, with Zeke.
And I ran away with the dog.
Yeah. I mean, you went back eventually, but yeah, you ran away with the dog. And so
I did. I ran away from East 17th to what, like East 53rd?
Yeah. Yeah. Medicine Town.
I think I took him for a walk.
You took him for
I told my mom I was taking him for a walk, and then I just got in a cab, and then I got to your house, and then I was like, I had no idea what to do. Like, okay, now I've run away.
Now, well, I can't remember if we spent the night or not. I know my mom called your mom and was like, you know, Annie's here. I think you should know. And your mom was like, no, she's not. She went for a walk.
I remember your mom was awesome. No. I remember like the three of us lying in bed being like,
phone was ringing and it was your mom, and we were just like, my mom's the adult. And then we're all like cowered in the corner and like listened to the message. We're like, we're not gonna get that. We're gonna we're just gonna like hang out with Annie for a bit. Like, her mom can get her back later. Like, my mom's just like, I don't wanna deal with that right now. I don't
wanna- Your mom's like, I don't wanna be involved in this.
Well, I mean, I guess she had her bit. Like, she called her and like Vicky was like, oh, she's not there, and then, you know, then I guess when your mom called back, it was like,
I know, I totally get where your mom was coming from.
Yeah, it was like, no, I'm not dealing with that right now. Maybe we can handle that later.
I love your mom.
By the time. Yeah.
No. Anyway, I feel like my like interest in dogs was like a defining characteristic of my childhood, but it always felt like a little. Like, I don't know, like I never felt like it was something to be proud of or like an interest to really like dig down into. It felt more like this sort of like this side thing that was like not quite shameful, but like on the side of like I almost like dogs were like baby blankets to me. Like, I felt better when there was a dog around, and like that felt.
I mean, they are so comforting, you know. I mean, I do still see that, and sometimes I see dogs and I almost think that they're Zeb, you know, like they stare at me and I stare at them with that sort of strange recognition that you attribute. Oh, well,
it elicits like a feeling in you that's similar to the feeling that you had with Zeb.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think it's just when someone you love passes, whether it's a dog or a person, like I think it's just sort of, and you feel that warmth like in something else, it's easy to kind of project and kind of transcribe that other person in your mind. I mean, I remember when my mom passed, I was like, you know, my Aunt Pat had a cat who was around long before, you know, like long before my mom had passed, but I was like, did she go in the cat? Is the cat now my, I mean, it's just like, I mean, even though I knew it wasn't, like there's that, you know, momentary thing, you're kind of like just sort of looking for that presence in something else. And so with Zeb, I remember once seeing a dog in the street years after he died, and just sort of thinking, God, there's just something so Zeb about him. Like, is it Zeb?
What did you think when I told you I was going to become a dog trainer?
Well, it wasn't like there was like a grand coming out.
There wasn't a grand coming out. I feel like to me, it felt like I was like telling people, like, I've decided to become a dog trainer. Like, it felt like a coming out.
I think for me, it felt like, gradual, like there was a progression, you know. I mean, we were writing, we were journalists,
right?
We were increasingly disillusioned, understandably, as we all, I think every journalist I know kind of has become, you know. Many of the journalists I know have kind of like myself have sort of switched over to some form of advertising or branded content or, you know, content strategy. I am that, but God knows what that means. But, you know, I mean, I think you were, as always, ahead of the curve. You know, you lost interest in it before I did.
Losing interest isn't quite what I would say, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean,
the benefits were no longer outweighing the difficulties.
Yes. And so you started by taking, you know, some dog training classes, and you were getting really into it, but I don't think that you were, it was like, it started kind of with like training Amos, you know, but I don't think it was like, from my memory, it wasn't like it started out as a commercial endeavor necessarily. You know, I know, you know, you took them for a while, maybe like while you were a journalist, and it was just like an interest or a hobby. And then you're doing some dog walking, and then And then I guess it all just, it just sort of kind of, it made sense. It all kind of came together. I don't remember.
Yeah. It's funny because like when I went to Karen Pryor Academy and I remember telling people, and you were, I guess you were living in Dubai at that time, yeah. I think. And yeah. it definitely followed like a period of like, I don't know, like a year of feeling like, oh my God, what am I going to do with my life? Like this kind of like, yeah. I mean, something that I think a lot of people have had at one point or the other in the last, you know, certainly around then, that was like, you know, the 2008, 2009, 2010 craziness. And now again, but anyway, I remember at first thinking like, oh, okay, I'm going to become a dog trainer. And like, then I'm going to make money being a dog trainer. And this one guy I knew who was like an editor was like, oh, and then you're going to like write a memoir about the experience. I was like, no, like, I'm just going to go to dog training school so I can make a living being a dog trainer.
Oh my God, it's like a editor kind of mentality. It's like everything is going to be a memoir or like some kind of like
story
book, you know, like, yeah, or story, something you can sell.
And I remember talking also to Kiki Ablon, who's an editor and writer who's now also a professional dog trainer, and she and I made that transition around the same time. And she said something like, I just want to be someone who does things. I don't need to be someone who like writes about things and comments on things or something like that, in a way that made sense to me. Anyway, but then, I mean, of course, then it was like a path from there to school for the dogs from graduating for one program. And but anyway, I guess I was just curious if it seemed like, oh, that makes sense that Annie's doing that, or if it seemed like some out of the blue thing.
I mean, it did make sense because, I mean, Amos was like just so well trained and like, and you had so much fun kind of training him all of these like in ways that were like really unique and like very you. And, you know, so it didn't seem like, yeah, it didn't seem like out of the blue for sure, right. You know. And, you know, I just think you're very, it's like very enterprising and very innovative. And I think it's just kind of really cool to sort of see all of the qualities that you have that like, you know, made you really great in journalism, but like, you know, project, directed into an area that, you know, you really love and have a lot of fun with. And it just makes it like, you know, it just makes it like really interesting. And it's just kind of fun to see those instincts, you know, in this other much more positive kind of, you know, place in society, you know, because I mean, sometimes, you know, I mean, look, I have
a lot of respect. Sweet of you. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have a lot of great respect for journalism. You know, I think particularly in this day and age when they're like being like demonized, you know, but, you know, sometimes to be a journalist, you know, it does feel like a sorrowful kind of profession. You know, I mean, there's many different kinds of journalists, but, you know, there can be a part of it that just doesn't feel like you're spreading joy in any way, shape, or form, you know. Yeah. So to kind of be in a profession where it is about spreading joy, and I just think it's, you know, I just think it's important to make that transition. I just think it's
true. I've never thought about it in that way, but it definitely feels like a better fit in that way. And like I have great respect for journalists, but I felt like I was never, you know, moved by like a feeling of, I mean, I think probably you too. Like I was never moved by a feeling of like mission and passion. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was moved by trying to make a living, and like, I liked writing and I liked reporting. Like I liked all the parts, but there wasn't some like actual fire of, I mean, and I, you know, I liked the like glory of the byline or whatever, but it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It wasn't,
yeah. Absolutely.
But now I feel like, oh, like I can't not be passionate about this thing. Like it's too, and I guess they're, you know, journalists, I mean, thank goodness, must feel passionate about like finding the truth and finding the great story and all of that. And glad those people are doing it. And
yeah,
hope somehow they're making a living.
No, for sure.
I think all of them should just leave what they're doing and become dog trainers. So. Okay. Let's hear your moth story.
Okay.
In all of its glory. I'll try not to interrupt you because we can just pretend it's actually the moth.
Absolutely. So when I was 8 years old, I became a loan shark. I mean, I'll admit it wasn't a natural fit. I've always been short and I couldn't do one pull-up on the monkey bars, so my upper body strength wasn't really up to snuff. Plus, I couldn't ride a bike to chase after anyone who might have defaulted. So really, not a great fit. But I got the idea from my dad. He took me down to the bank to open my first savings account and to learn about the concept of interest. So when the bank teller showed me a calculator of what my $100 investment would be in a year, I wasn't too impressed. You know, I kind of thought, I can get a better rate on my own. So basically, I started peddling to my neighbors. I went door to door, but instead of selling Girl Scout cookies, I was selling a very reasonable $100 loan at the exceptional rate of 10% interest a month. So I just really wanted a very fast return. And I remember one of my neighbors basically saying, like, that those are mafia rates. But I was not put off. So
wait, how old were you? How old were you?
8.
Sorry to interrupt.
No,
you were 8?
Yeah. No, you can
and you understood, like, percentages?
Well, yeah. I mean, my dad went, you know, took me to the bank and basically they were like, you know, had a calculator. And my dad was very big into teaching me these things. Like, opening my savings account, like, was a way to understand percent. So, you know.
Did you have a passbook for your bank account?
I mean, it was a while ago. So back then, yeah. They give you a passbook.
I had that too, where they like printed out every line in the little booklet.
Yeah. You had to like balance everything. Yeah. So, you know, at 10% interest a month, I didn't get too many takers. So, however, there was one, a charming next door neighbor who, it would later turn out, was one of England's most notorious society con men. And he went by the name of Count Guy de Mortfort. So even then, at 8, I sensed that Guy was a high-risk loan. There was something a little off about Guy. He had a lot of stories about his life that, now they're, like, really suspect. But even then, I was like...
Where was this again? Malibu?
Yeah, this is my dad's place in Malibu. So he was the next-door neighbor on a property next door. And...
What's his name again? Guy de Mortfort.
Yeah, Count Guy de Mortfort. some of his stories. He was a secret agent. He fought off 2 Siberian tigers. I think with his bare hands. Like, it was like crazy.
Did he tell you these stories?
I mean, not sat me down personally, but there was always stories. Like, he was always kind of holding court, you know, and in the sort of community we lived in, it was it was very British. There were a lot of British expats. The landlady and the landlord were a couple. They were British, and so they would always have like all of the tenants over for tea, and it was in their exquisite Malibu garden. So it was this sort of strange little life. And he was often holding court, and he would, you know, tell these stories. And I think, another one was, he was the target of the royal family because he, like, knew too much about them. And that's why he fled to America. I mean, it was all, like, you know, so crazy. And I think he had, like, a biography, like, an autobiography we were reading parts of. And there was this one bit where he talks about, like, you know, his family being killed by gorillas. And I was like, that's not true. Like, and I thought that it meant, you know, because I was 8, I had thought it meant like gorillas as in like the monkey, but it was gorillas, you know, like GUE, you know, like militias. Either way.
Maybe they really were gorillas.
Maybe. So he was a great storyteller, and that's basically, I think, why my dad really kind of gravitated towards him. You know, I mean, he didn't trust him, but as a former screenwriter, you know, my dad's motto was always, don't let the truth ruin a perfectly good story. So, so he liked Guy, you know, because Guy was always reliable for a good story. And the other thing to know about Guy, so this was something that was really a prominent feature of his, was that every time we saw him, he always had a different, seemingly very serious, very rich girlfriend. You know, like every week he'd have a different woman over, and they were always kind of young, and you know, it always seemed like they were like a real item, and they always seemed to have money. So I understood from my dad that these women often loaned Guy money. So when Guy offered to borrow my $100, I had second thoughts. I was like, I don't know. And I looked at my dad, and I was kind of like, should I do this? And he just threw up his hands, and he was like, basically was like, not my money, it's your decision, which is kind of crazy, but I mean, you know, I guess from his perspective, it was like $100, you know, and maybe it'd be a good life lesson to me. And so I agreed because I was kind of greedy and I'm like, okay, like I do want that 10% interest. You know, I want that money to like increase value as quickly as possible. So he wrote me a post-dated check for the amount right then on the spot. And I was like, okay, you know, whatever, what the hell? Like, he's my neighbor. I know where he lives. Like, he's not going to get away, you know, by not paying me back. You know, I'll get it eventually. Now, it should probably come as no surprise that the check bounced. And it wasn't long after that that Guy got arrested. So I'm not saying I had anything to do with it, but he did get arrested at our house. So we invited him over for dinner and we went out for pre-dinner drinks. And when we returned, the FBI were waiting in our driveway. I think he was arrested for forging a U.S. passport. So they're dragging him away in handcuffs. My dad's running after the feds with a camera. He's like cursing at them and screaming and being like, this is a mistake. You know, we're going to sue you. And he's like, you know, flash, taking pictures. And I'm like totally flabbergasted. I'm like, what is going on? Like, I, you know, just to see like someone get arrested like in real life. And these, you know, not even by police, but by these like federal agents. It was all like just crazy.
Wow.
So then a little, like literally 5 minutes later, one of my dad's best friends shows up, maybe 10 minutes later. And this was someone who lived like at least a half an hour away. And he's like, oh yeah, we're having dinner with Ben tonight. And I was like, I thought we were having dinner with Guy. He's like, oh no, Guy got arrested. And it just kind of dawned on me then that my dad had double booked, almost as if he knew Guy was going to get arrested. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So about a year later, I got a call from the TV show Hard Copy, who were doing a segment on Guy, and they asked me to do an interview. So the film crew met me at my mom had a hat studio, a hat shop in Lower Manhattan. So they agreed to meet
you
me.
You were nine at this point.
Yeah, I'm nine. I just started a new school, you know, and so yeah. So this film crew meets me at my mom's hat studio. After the interview, they ask for a shot of me walking down the street wearing one of her hats. So I'm like, okay. So, but you know, when the piece aired, this is kind of how it went. You know, it goes, Guy de Mortfort had an illustrious career as a con man. For years, he seduced beautiful women and broke their hearts and their bank accounts. Until he crossed paths with 8-year-old Daisy Carrington. So they're like totally painting me as like the like vigilante who like 8-year-old vigilante who like got back. You
know. And then you're walking down the street wearing like a hat and your puff sleeves, I'm sure.
Oh my God. No, I mean, it's like black and white footage. I'm like walking down the street. I look like a crime fighting Blossom. I look like I'm coming to get him, you know? I mean, so I don't know. Like, I never really knew how Hard Copy found out about that story. Looking back on the segment, because I still have it, the photos of Guy being arrested, the black and white ones that my dad took, they aired in the same segment, which didn't really clue me into the fact that until like recently that maybe my dad set Guy up and then sold his story to the tabloids. Like, never occurred to me until like a couple years ago. I'm like, is that what happened? And I mean, he always told me that basically the landlord next door had a really bad judge, you know, sense of character. He was a bad judge of character, and he rented his two units out to two different con men. And the other con man, who had some other game but didn't like Guy being on his territory, this is the story my dad always told me, he was the one that called the feds and turned Guy in because he wanted Guy off the property. He didn't want him like in his vicinity.
Only one con man per property.
Yeah.
So did you ever look him up?
Yeah, there's articles on him. I mean, he's actually a bit kind of illustrious. There was like this whole profile on him. He didn't stay in American jail forever. I mean, he was back in the UK at some point. He actually was kind of notorious. Like he. You know, so if you do look him up, I mean, you can find him online. There have been stories written on him. I think that there might have been like a documentary on him at some point, you know, so it's, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't just me and my run-in and hard copy. I mean, he was like a, in the 80s, you know, popular tabloid fodder, you know, particularly in the UK. I mean, I didn't even sniff him out. I mean, I had nothing to do with this, but the way a hard copy ran the story, it was definitely like, it was me. I put him behind bars. Like, I'm like this like 8-year-old incredible vigilante. And not often, but there were a couple of times, like in the few years after that, that every now and then I would get recognized. Like, I remember a couple of people would be like, I think I saw you. You like put this con man behind jail. I was like, yeah. Like, I think it happened twice, but it was kind of very funny that it did. It was like, oh my God.
All right. Last Daisy story for this tangentially related dog training episode. Tell me about your relationship with Mike TV.
Oh my God. Okay, so I was, as a kid, I was really terrified of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the movie.
The movie?
Yeah. Now, I had as a super side note, I had a massive crush on Gene Wilder. So that's why I saw the movie, because I love Gene Wilder. Was like, I mean, I even wrote him a love letter as a kid, like loved him. So, you know, but it was the one movie I couldn't watch. Cause when I watched it as like a, like, I think maybe when I was like 7 or something, super terrified of it. So, you know, overcoming this fear, like I think when I was about 12, a friend of mine in middle school, we, you know, it kind of became our personal cult classic, like watched it again as an, you know, as a young, you know, preteen, and was able to watch it and not be super terrified of, you know, blueberry girls and drowning in chocolate and all of the things that are genuinely scary about the movie, and kind of appreciates campiness. And so we basically watched it, you know, it's like, you know, you get obsessed with movies. So one of my friends and I, we watched it every week we watched it, and just, I don't know, became absolutely obsessed with it. And I think we kind of had a crush on Mike TV, because he was, you know, the actor at the time, you know, when it was filmed, he probably would have been about the age we were when we were watching it, you know, 13, 14. And he was handsome. So, you know, we were looking at the credits, and then we noticed that the actor that played Mike TV had a really unique name. And his name was Paris Themon. So we were just like, well, let's like look him up. Now, this is before the internet. So basically, I literally dialed information, dialed 411. And was like, give me the number to Paris Themon. And it was listed. He had a listed phone number. So called the phone number, and this guy answers the phone, and he's like, oh yeah, Paris doesn't live here anymore. He's moved to California. So we're like, oh, can we have that number? And he's like, who is this? We're like, friends. And he's like, oh, okay. Gave us his number. Didn't think that was suspicious at all. And so we ended up calling California, and we got him, and we were like, are you the Paris Themon who's Mike TV? And he was actually lovely, but he was, you know, he was laughed, and he was like, I'm not admitting to anything. But I mean, we ended up talking to him for like, for a couple of hours, I think, you know, he was very sweet, totally indulged us. He wasn't an actor anymore at that point. You know, answered all of our kind of burning, questions about, you know, various gestures or this or that, you know, kind of geeky stuff that maybe, you know, between the characters of Mike TV and Willy Wonka, and, you know, asked for, you know, got his interpretation of events, and he sent us a signed autographed picture as well. He said he did not get very many of these calls at this point, that there was one person who sort of in shaky handwriting would send him fan letters every now and then, but that was...
I think that's such a sweet story. It's like the most sweet, wholesome story of like pre-internet fandom.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, it was nice that we were able to kind of make that connection. And yeah, and then that was it. I think probably around, you know, that was enough to sort of satisfy my kind of Willy Wonka obsession. And I don't think I really watched it quite as frequently after that. It was just like, it was nice closure, I suppose, to the whole thing.
To your Willy Wonka period.
Yes.
Well, I would love to watch Willy Wonka with you and Laura and Bruno and Magnolia.
Yeah, I mean, it is a scary movie for a young kid.
It's scary,
I mean,
but when you also, the funny thing is, like, it looks so rough around the edges compared to how things look now.
Yeah, I mean,
like, all the special effects are like not that special, but it kind of adds to the charm.
No, for sure. Although I don't know if Bruno and Maggie yet have, like, you know, if their special effects, like, taste of are, like, super developed. Maybe they are. You never know. Like, you
know. Yeah. At this point, I think we could totally thrill them with it.
Yeah. Well, thrill them.
I mean, I love the music.
One of the two.
I love the music. The Candyman can.
Yes. No, absolutely. I mean, I even wrote fan fiction.
Well, I think actually inspired by your obsession with Mike TV in college, I had to do some kind of like, I guess like internet research project back, or I don't really remember what it was, but it was back when like an internet research project was like a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, and I like tried to find the Oompa Loompas, like what different Oompa Loompas were doing then, now, I mean, yeah. Now, then, it was like a funny early internet rabbit hole I went down. I don't think I reached out to any of them, but it was fun just like finding them. And I'm sure Mike TV probably now has like a Wikipedia page and whatever. Maybe. Back then, you had to actually call 411 to find these people.
Yeah, I had to do the sleuthing.
Anyway, thank you so much for indulging me. And I miss you guys. Can't wait for you to be back in New York.
Absolutely. Well, we miss you too, and we will, and we'll definitely be back for Maggie's birthday, right? In January.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So that'll be super fun. So we'll, I don't know what we'll do. God, come winter, and you know the outdoors isn't really as much of a thing, but we'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out. I love you.
I love you too, honey.